This is CliffCentral.com.
I'm Phumi Mashego and the time is 4 minutes past 10. New time slot and you're listening to Womandla. Thank you for tuning in. But before, so that was like an awesome song. But before I go into this show, I think the one song that for me always epitomizes the conversation that I'm about to have is Macklemore. I'm going to start here before I take you into the deep, deep, deep conversation we're about to have.
She keeps me warm. She keeps me warm.
I think when the song came out, one of the things that for me in particular was so amazing about the song, besides the fact that it's got the melody, it's got this awesome woman, fierce voice, is the idea that the song is on about. We read about it, and when Caitlyn Jenner, I think the moment Caitlyn Jenner on that Vanity Fair, for those of you that do watch the Kardashians, unfortunately, I missed that whole thing because I don't watch the Kardashians. So I missed that whole thing when Bruce Jenner was going through the transition. And suddenly there was this Caitlyn Jenner. And I didn't know what was going on or who Caitlyn Jenner was because I'm a little bit too young to, and I missed the Bruce Jenner era. But it was so fascinating to watch. And when the first season came out of I Am Kate, episode one, episode two, by the time episode three came along, I was completely tired of it. I was over it and I couldn't watch it anymore. But it raised so many questions and so many conversations. And besides the fact that she almost broke the internet, as they say, when she came out on the Vanity Fair, what she actually broke open is she broke open the silence. She broke open the feelings that a lot of people have and that a lot of people weren't talking about, weren't saying anything about. And then I started thinking about South Africa. In South Africa, we have a huge LGBTI movement. We have a very loud and fun and identified movement, but we also have lots of problems in that even with our most progressive constitution, even as everybody is free and allowed to be free and allowed to be themselves, we have the most backward people. We have backward people in that we see in newspapers around the country every day almost, we see stories of violation of people living their life. And 2 weeks ago, I actually saw an article about a young girl from Vosloorus, from the East Rand, who 2 years ago, my guest is here and looking fabulous. Hello. I'm just setting the scene and having the conversation around South Africa and really being so, in one hand, completely forward, completely amazing, amazing constitution. Everybody is equal in front of the law. And then having the most backward people in it, where we're unable to have honest conversations, even within our families, with each other about. And there's lots of stuff about that. But let me introduce you to my listeners. Tell me how I say your surname, Jabu.
Pereira, hi.
Pereira.
Yeah.
I worried about that. If it is, was it one of those like Paella and Paella? I'm just a Zulu girl, okay?
Do not. I got the surname and I don't know where it comes from, but yeah.
Jabu, thank you so much for making it. I know you're very busy and jet setting all over the world, changing lives. Thank you for being here with us today.
Yeah, I'm really happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
I read your, so I've been stalking you, right, on the internet. Mm-hmm. I've been all over your websites. I've then been checking all of the links and trying to find you. And then I read your profile yesterday and I thought, how? Only 2012. This organization. So tell me about Iranti. I love the fact that the word means memory. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the organization Iranti.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we basically, we started in 2012. really, you know, sitting around myself and Nebo Msangi and thinking through how do we really increase kind of storytelling, reporting in relation to the lives of LGBTI people, which is lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and intersex persons within South Africa, but also within the continent. And given just the kind of negative reporting that happens or the incorrect reporting that happens within mainstream media, we really felt that as people from this community that we needed to kind of create a media space, almost like a civic journalism space where we own and claim our own narratives and our own stories.
So you yourself identify yourself as a transgender activist.
Right.
Why activist? Why not just person living their lives fighting for a better society like I think everybody tries to do every day? Why activist?
I guess because it consumes my life in all ways that it does. It's not something that, you know, I can do from 8 to 4 or 5 and then lock it up in a cupboard. And, you know, wherever I navigate my body and my space, there are always potential issues of threat, of humiliation, of different things that happens within. So I think being an activist is about just embodying that within oneself completely. And I think being an activist is about really a self-transformative process about how do we embody the values that we live. And it's not just a headspace or an intellectual space. It's an actual walk the talk living kind of space that is always there in terms of values and so forth. So I like to see myself as an activist, someone who's actively always thinking and being in the world and always questioning and trying to make a difference. And that is a 24/7 thing.
So I love the words. You know, I love the words that mm-hmm. in the NGO, NPO space that you use words like navigating my body. Because I think as a woman living in South Africa, every day is a navigating my body experience. Every day is an experience of whether it is being marginalized because you are a black woman, whether it is being marginalized because you are a woman in a particular work environment, whether it is being marginalized or feeling threatened, which was one of the words that you used as well, in particular spaces and not being completely free and allowed to be in those spaces. I would love to know your experience of navigating your body. What that for you? Because I would not, looking at you walking down the street, I would never think that this guy feels somewhat threatened or this guy feels mm-hmm. out of place or out of sync. Mm-hmm. So tell me about that experience for you.
Okay, that's a really interesting perspective because, you know, being transgender and really transitioning in my life at a much older age, I mean, I'm now going to be 45
what?
Years old, which is, so I think...
I'm looking at you proper. You must talk to me about that moisturizer.
Thank you.
45?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, well, flattery will get you everywhere. Thank you for that. But, you know, when I grew up, basically, I was born really at the time of apartheid, firstly. And now I'm 45 and I live in a democracy. And so I guess that first navigational part of one's body is that very experience of... having memories of as a child born in Port Elizabeth and going on school trips, for example, to the Port Elizabeth Museum. And just across the museum is the beautiful beach of PE. And my very first memories of that is seeing these boards that said whites only beaches and wanting to go to the bathroom and seeing that it's a whites only bathroom. And I guess as somebody who's 10 years old, you know, and your body and your brain becomes conditioned that you're legally not okay to be somewhere, right? And so you as a child in this hot summer and in this stuffy bus cannot go and put your body in that water. And so I think, you know, growing up, you realize that you're already conditioned as a child to believe that your body is inferior because it's black, it's inappropriate, and it doesn't belong in that water. And so I think there's a lot of things growing up in this body, when I talk about navigation, is about that. It's about how do you go from being born in apartheid into a democracy, and then how do you celebrate that very same body that was conditionally oppressed during apartheid? The schools we had to go to, the trips we had to be on. You know, I remember the colored beach being like packed with blue bottles. I don't know if you know what blue bottles are, but that stuff really stings the hell out of you, right? And so, you know, when you realize that this really piece of crappy beach is where your body is assigned to be as a child, and that other beach is not assigned for you. And I think, you know, there's so many memories that one has about where one's body has been. And I think also having lived half of my life, at least most of my life now, just before my transition as female, yeah, there's a whole lot of issues about what is appropriate and what is inappropriate in terms of, you know, a whole range of issues around sexual harassment, around female masculinities and just female femininity and what is appropriate and what's not appropriate and just the kind of oppressive bodily issues that women have to suffer on a daily, regular basis in terms of public space. We see that in terms of some countries who even regulate kids having longer school uniforms so that boys are not tempted. I have no idea how
I'm still angry about that. The day's coming when I have that rant. But
you know, but also now having to navigate my transition and thinking about male identity and transgender male identity, not, you know, not cisgender male identity. But as transgender male identity and having been in this transition process for at least 2 years, you really, really begin to see just how much male privilege exists in society. And
right. Thank you for saying that. You get a high five for that one.
Thank you. But you know,
are you enjoying the privileges, Jabu? Are you enjoying the privileges?
There are things that I am enjoying. For example, I will give you some examples, like the ability to, when I visit my family, I can walk down on the coastline at 10 p.m. and 11 p.m. and nobody would mess with me. In fact, if people see me sometimes, they fear me, just from representation also, which I don't understand either. But I think that...
Yeah, because everybody's afraid of colored guys.
Yeah, we're gangsters,
especially
right?
Especially in PPE.
Right, so there's all these kind of stereotypes. And I think, you know, if I, in my transition, dress in those particular stereotypes, there are some factors that you realize, oh my gosh, I can navigate public space in the way that I've never, ever experienced in my 42 years of existence. Mm-hmm. You know, when you go to a restaurant, your treatment is so much more different. You know, and when I'm with my female friends, like, they really almost don't exist in terms of service. And these kind of things are things that one has to challenge.
And everybody brings the check to you.
I know, right? And that's wrong. But it's just, it's unbelievable that that there is so much privilege around men. And I think that for me is a major challenge. Being raised and being very super conscious as a feminist, how one has to break down patriarchy in so many different ways. And just how that struggle is so, so real. On so many different levels. And of course, within our work environment and the work we do, we see that, you know, in terms of just the kind of physical violent attacks on female bodies and what that is about in terms of various forms of hatred, etc.
Jabu, is it, was it easy for you to own some of that privilege that comes with the male body. You say by the time you were 42, so there were lots of levels of discomfort for all those many years. But transitioning from a black male who was to be unseen, black female to be unseen, to be over there, and then transitioning to becoming the ultimate, because now you are a black male, you know, you're the ultimate in free South Africa. Was it easy? Was it a great place to step into? Was it freeing for you to like throw away the burden of being just another little girl?
No, absolutely. I think it's something that there's so many things I don't want to throw away, which is...
Really?
Absolutely. I think there's so many things around understanding why feminism is important, understanding why the assertion of agency is so important, and why that fight against violence against women, for example, is so important. I think what's more important, I think for men in particular, and in my transition, is how men can become more in touch with their feminine side. And I think, you know, there's so much things around negative masculinities, you know, and I think the burden, particularly when I think about race and the burden around black male masculinities, because of course when we look at the framing of violence in South Africa, it's always kind of steered and geared towards looking at the violence in relation to black men. Like when people think about close your eyes and think about who do you think of as a criminal, like people may unlikely think of a white man as that.
I saw a picture on Facebook a couple of days ago which even shocked me, with some two white guys that were did you see those two white guys that were arrested by like the ADT or something in that, and it was two white guys lying with their hands, and I was just like, how did they figure out that these guys were the Tsotsis? I really, like, that was my big thing. How did they get that? I would never have thought those guys are Tsotsis. And it shocked me to think that I have that prejudice.
Right.
As well.
Completely. And I think that's the issue around, you know, what are parents really teaching their sons, you know, and how are men constructing their own identities in relation to masculinities? Because I think there's a lot of positive masculinities that can be embodied. I mean, why do we praise men who carry their babies? I don't get that. You know, that should be an extension of fatherhood. But because it's such an invisible visual thing that we see in society, like when a man carries a child, people applaud that man because it's like, oh my God, this is amazing. Like,
how cute,
right? And of course women have to do this, you know, and et cetera. And that's how society constructs all these stereotypes around female, male, and gender stereotyping. So I feel like in my transition, I'm a little bit caught up in kind of thinking through a lot of these things. But of course, also socializing. I mean, I remember my first experience going to the men's bathroom. You know, men are disgusting, by the way, in the bathroom. and they're not very hygienic.
I often go to men's bathrooms because they have less queues.
Yes, exactly.
I often go to men's bathrooms and pretend like...
You're right.
Just quickly walk into... Because there's no queues in the men's bathroom. So how was that? Were you just like, this is disgusting, I want to go back to the girls' toilet?
I know, right? It smells great. Like, you know, people smile at you. It's like a different experience. but I just think that there's so many things that one just has to like overcome. And then there are things that you just have to question and
so
think
is
about.
The process, you say that the process has been 2 years for you. Is the process designed to be a long process to allow you the opportunity to go through all of those things? Because that's how, this is going to sound so like tacky, but when I was pregnant and had my son, at the end of it, I understood why it takes such a long time, even though I still feel like it doesn't take long enough because I was still unprepared. But because of all of that time of kind of internalizing it, digesting it, the discomfort, the change being slow. Is it designed that way? Or was that just your particular experience?
You know, I wish that I was born in this generation, actually, to be honest. Like the generation of social media, the generation of DSTV, and, you know, where my nieces and my nephews understand what transgender is. And, you know, when I grew up, there was just no language, particularly for females who were transitioning to male. There was a lot more language around male to female transitions.
Again, with the male privilege.
Right, exactly, right.
Guys just get it easy all the time.
Right. And so there was so much more visibility, in, I guess, or information around a male to female transition and kind of access around that. And I really think that probably hindered me or prevented me from thinking through a transition much earlier. So,
really,
I think that probably finding language, finding a supportive environment is like, you know, when that light bulb moment is like, oh, this is actually who I am. This is actually what, you know, there's a whole lot of things that begin to kind of the puzzle starts fitting together in relation to so many challenges that I've had in my life and just, you know, around my body, around issues, around my identity and so on. But just not really finding that language, not really finding that community. And I think now society and access is so much more easier. And I see that. And I see that in younger children, youth who are in their transition, and I just think like, oh, I wish I was that. But I don't regret my life experience. It's just that there's so many things that hinders one in so many ways. And also, you know, your own sense of self-prejudice, your own sense of like, you know, I when I came out at 22 to my family, I came out as lesbian. And that was already hard because, you know, I grew up in a very traditional Catholic family, you know.
I'm a Catholic girl. I get that.
You know, completely judgment. Conservative. Exactly. You know,
judgment is just par for the course.
Right. Right. and so.
And self deprivation. Think less.
Right. And I remember my first information about, I guess, same sex love or sexual orientation issues, was actually going to the university library to read about sexual orientation. There was nobody to talk to in a little city like Port Elizabeth to say, well, this is kind of how I'm feeling and I don't know what this is about and who can I talk to, you know. And so I think the journey has not been easy, especially for people in my generation and older.
So that is finding the language, I think, because one of the things that your organization does is documenting, particularly in vernaculars, the life experience of transgender individuals. And that for me was also very fascinating because I think about it and I think, sure, there's more than just the issue of self-identity. There's also the issue of identifying yourself to people around you. So when you come out and say to your family, I'm lesbian or I'm gay, or I don't feel that my body accurately, you know, is been assigned accurately, right words, ne? I'm so after I spoke to you yesterday and the fact that you were just like, language, girl, I'm so conscious now if I'm saying the right things. I've been like reading up. But then I thought, imagine all of those children in rural areas, in the township, who are discovering this about themselves, who are discovering their sexuality, and then having to say to their grandmother, this is how I feel. This is who I am. And so the power for me in documenting in the vernaculars in particular has been so immense. Have you found that the people that have come and joined your organization or the programs that you are running feel the same way about the vernacular expression of their experience?
Yeah, totally. Definitely. I mean, I think one of the immense challenges for our families is often just that real lack of information. I mean, I think when people decide to become parents, there should be like a crash course on values and information and human rights and different things about diversity, because your children may not be who you are, okay? And like, maybe you look identical or there's a genetic makeup of some sorts, but you know what we notice a lot, and I think even with my own self, was always that element of fear of coming out. And that also prolongs so many things around one's own self-happiness, etc., because you always fear that rejection. And in many cases, with the kinds of cases that we deal with, that is a very real reality for so many kids who, you know, we have one case at the moment of a brilliant young transgender guy whose mother has just disowned him, and he's homeless and had to stop studying, and you know, just so many people who, you know, there's been cases of families even trying to poison their kids, you know, like, we'd rather like have you dead than have you alive, because this brings shame, it brings and you know, like, this is not, again, you know, in terms of culture and practice and so forth. And so we find a lot of situations within the families where families are suddenly confronted with new challenges, and actually exciting challenges, I think, because, you know, not everybody's the same in one's family. You know, there's the crazy and there's the happy one, and then
there's the
drama one, the alcoholic and the gossip one, and, you know, and then there's the transgender one or the gay one or the lesbian one, etc. And also in our families, we have, you know, relatives with disabilities. Not everybody's an ableist, etc., you know. So the diversity in our families should be embodied. And I think often the first point of call when families don't know what to do or understand what this is about rejection. It's about really harming someone that may not have the ability to find another home or to find a new sense of livelihood. And this is a real challenge, you know. I mean, I think for my family, I think they've been amazing, and they've really worked through so many things from my coming out to now. And I don't think it's always easy, and I don't think it's always, you know, they don't understand everything necessarily, but I don't understand everything about their lives either.
How did you do that with your family?
Okay, well, I had two coming outs.
So they had a practice coming out.
Yes,
they had the warm up. Real one. And they had 20 years in between.
Right, exactly. You know, so they've had like a good two rounds.
No, but really, if you think about your experience, mm-hmm. what do you think you did correctly with your family that people could learn from?
Okay, well, you know, so my family, let me just, a short history about my family is that they don't talk about anything historical. So if there's like some child that was born out of marriage, there's no conversation around these things.
Like all black families.
So I don't even know why I have this Portuguese surname, for example, right?
Like, isn't that typical of black families, though?
Exactly.
You just need to find that one aunt that's willing to have the gossip.
So, exactly. So there's this kind of thing that we say sometimes, which may not always be correct, that, you know, like, why should I come out to my family? Because we don't talk about these things.
They can
They can see, you know. I'm obvious.
They can see me most.
You know. But for me, that was coming out was a real important issue because I'd been raised in a family of secrecies, you know, where I can't explain anything about my background, my genealogy, like, you know. And so I think when I was around about 22, I read this book called Coming Out. And so I thought, oh, great. Like, you know, just like I found this book called What a Lesbian Looks Like. So I thought, clearly I won't be in this book, you know. But it was just like a book of stories of different diverse women who identified as lesbian. And so one of them, you know, et cetera, could have been me. And so the Coming Out book was very much a helpful book. So what I did was I took one of the the tips out of this book, and I, maybe it was the cowardice tip, but I decided to write like this open family letter of disclosure, you know. It was like, so it was like, read and pass it along.
Did
you know?
You write one letter or lots of letters?
No,
and
one.
Then give everybody, read and pass it along.
Yeah.
Ha, ha, ha,
yeah.
Ha, ha. And who did you give it to first?
Well, I thought I
gave it,
you know, I gave it to my older sister because I thought she's like progressive. Apparently she fainted in the workplace.
No.
And she didn't deal with it. And then she didn't talk to me for 2 years. So it was quite a hard thing. Yeah, it was. There were some really difficult moments, and then I endured daily night laying of hands on me and prayers.
Oh no, man.
That's
sweet, you know, though. You know, that's,
it was like
that's
a lot of
though.
Blessings, you know. but I think over time, you know, my family just, yeah, I think just with conversations and talking and understanding, you know, there was a lot of embodying of issues. And then I think in 2014 when I decided, okay, well, now it's time for the next part of my coming out, you know. but I think by that time they had kind of like, they'd already known before I knew, because I changed my birth name. So my dead name, I don't use it anymore. And so
what's that, your dead name?
My dead name. So that my birth
name.
That's
a bit morbid.
I know. It's like dead and buried. And like even Home Affairs deleted it. It's like formatted.
Well done to you. You got Home Affairs to do something for you.
Yeah. I mean, especially when you discover your dead name means white breast. So it's like delete,
what?
Delete, 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 right?
White
so,
breast.
yeah. I mean, just the ironies of colored families giving their children British and Welsh names was really, really weird. So I then you know, decided I'm changing my name. Like, this is one of my processes. And so I think when I changed my name, my family already was already like, oh, this there's something different happening here. Exactly.
And how did the sister who fainted then take the second coming out?
Actually, amazingly well. She had 20 years of practice. But I think she did really, really well because, you know, she did one interview around families and families with LGBTI relatives and so on. And in that interview, it was way before I even transitioned. She had said she was very disappointed because I didn't tell anybody that I was now a boy. And I was very upset by this interview because I was like, I'm not a boy. I didn't come out. You know, but she was already like way, she was leaps ahead of me. And that was amazing. And I think so, I think my name change in one respects was one level of preparation, you know. And then it was like, okay, the next steps was like easier, you know. So they've been great. And I mean, you know, of course, there's all these amazing TV shows now, which are
TV
influencing
shows.
Things and negative and positive.
You okay,
know,
let's have it
let's
out.
Let's not talk about Caitlyn Jenner.
Let's
now.
Have it out. Because, so I don't watch the Kardashians, right?
Oh,
so
God.
I then didn't know what the, I and I'm too young to have known who Bruce Jenner was,
mm-hmm.
right? So I missed that whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, this Caitlyn Jenner and like mm-hmm. Vanity Fair and everybody's talking about it. And I'm going, what's going on? So I had to watch when I'm Kate came
mm-hmm.
out. I had
right.
to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched episode 1 and I watched episode 2 and then I couldn't handle going forward because I'm not that girl. I'm really not that girl that's like, but I was so deeply fascinated by Caitlyn Jenner and the story about Caitlyn.
Mm-hmm.
And more importantly, being in media myself, so fascinated by how easily she held the public conversation around it.
All right.
So now I want to know from the other side of the chair. I told you I'm a couch bitch, right? So when you're sitting on your couch, Caitlyn Jenner does what in your mind for the world?
Well, I mean, one of the interesting things about last year is that the most, one of the top, in the top five trending words on Twitter was transgender.
Really?
Interesting, right?
The whole year.
Yeah. And if you look at the statistics of what were the most top trending things, and probably Caitlyn was one of the people who may have brought that up in, you know, in, I mean, in the space of 24 hours, she had 1 million followers and she wasn't following anyone on Twitter. And so clearly she evoked something perhaps, and maybe that's the power of mainstream media, you know. And so, you know, equally, I also didn't kind of know who she was, and I don't follow sport, etc. And it's complex, and it's a very American story, and it's a very white narrative in terms of just, you know, a positive side of how people with privilege and money can positively transition in different ways. And it doesn't matter if you're politically stupid like her, you know, I think... you know, she really embodies so many other things around transition and access to medical health care, access to, you know, the extent of her wealth, etc. And so I think there's complexities in those media stories. There's complexities in media stories where you'll find articles like 12 transgender men you wouldn't think are trans, you know, because they all look like, you know, they all like immensely hot, and they all like, you know, they belong on like all these health men magazines, and you know, they're gorgeous, right? And so again, we play into like normative stereotypes about, you know, this whole notion of what this word, which is called passing. How transgender people should pass. In other words, where people don't really notice whether you are transgender because you fit into a male society or into a female society. And so that really skews the realities of trans people, because for the majority, for example, in our country, of transgender people don't have access to medical health
care. And there are only two places in the whole country that that actually will perform... The change.
Right. So in relation to surgeries, what we call gender-affirming surgeries, the waiting list on those, and in Groote Schuur and the Steve Biko Academic Hospital, you can wait between 10 to 25 years for your surgery.
What?
Yes.
Why? Because that's that many people on the list, or because there's just...
Because the hospital...
There's only one person every 6 months doing...
Well, exactly. No, the hospital has a peculiar policy, I think, around how many surgeries they can perform per year. And normally it's one or two. And so, and there's no real clear reason around that. And again, these are for people who don't have access to medical health care or money.
Because this is government.
So these are the government services,
institutions.
Right. Exactly. And then I think there's a lot of issues around the fact that transgender health is still so deeply pathologized. So, for example, you do need to go to a psychologist or psychiatrist to prove that you really need to transition. And so in the International Classification of Diseases, transgender health is still listed to be a gendered identity disorder. Just, you know, in 1990, homosexuality was just removed from the list of International Classification of Diseases. Homosexuality was classified as a mental disorder. And so, I mean, really, it's insane, you know, I mean, this whole kind of thinking about these classifications. And so to transition really is a challenge, because it's about who has access to a psychologist, who can pay for this, you know, paying for your hormones, etc.
Because the cost is immense.
Right.
The cost is immense. I can imagine what the cost of over 2 years transitioning has been for you.
Right. So there are trans people who identify as transgender who don't opt for surgeries. Some may opt for just to take hormones, etc. And some may just opt to take none of the others. So often, you know, when we talk about transgender people, people immediately think about, you know, are you having your top surgery, which is, you know, your gender.
What does that mean?
Top surgery for trans men means your chest surgery. Or people want to know whether you had your bottom surgery. You know, like, are you going to have, like, a penis now, etc. So people really tend to, like, fetishize or think about transgender people's bodies in relation to surgeries only, and not in relation to anything else that that pertains to a socialization of an identity.
Speaking of socialization, right, of identity and what? Fetishize? Oh, I can't even say that word. Mm-hmm. To make fetish. Jeez. Top five. And we spoke a little bit about this when we were getting ready for the show. Your top five most inappropriate questions that people ask.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I mean, that many.
Okay, I think...
Start from number five.
Okay. Well, the first questions are always about what surgeries did you have? Okay. So
people are interested in right, bodies.
In bodies.
Okay.
And so don't ask transgender people about surgeries. What was your name before? Don't ask transgender people about their dead names. You know? So you were a lesbian and are you heterosexual now? Okay. Transgender people can love who they like, and sexual orientation is completely different from your gender identity. Sexual orientation can be, transgender people can love all forms of bodies they desire. It could be transgender people, it could be heterosexual people, it could be gay people, etc. So that's the other question. When does your transition end? It's called transition. It's a verb. It's active.
Okay.
Yeah, I think some of those, you know, those are the first ones that come to mind, or
what's the worst thing you've ever been asked? The one that you then had to walk away from. You had to actually go, I'm unable to can.
I must say,
I'm leaving you here.
It's always it's the surgeries one, you know, because it's like, I just find that so strange. It's like, you know,
invasive.
It's pretty invasive. And I just don't know. I mean, I don't have issues with my body. I'm happy to show people whatever they like.
No!
But it's like, rather like, take me on a date and I'll show you my body. And, you know, like, you know, I think that's way more like sexy than like, you know, like, are you going to grow a penis? What happened. I went on a date and this woman asked me if I'm going to grow a penis. And I said, yeah, I water it every day, twice a day. So I think those are a little bit of like obsessive questions that people like ask and stuff like that, you know.
Right. I guess she didn't make it to see. Sure. Wow. So last question about Caitlyn Jenner.
Sure.
Because last one, I promise.
Okay.
Do you think Caitlyn Jenner is for real? Or do you think it's a money-making? She just couldn't handle not being part of the Kardashian crew. I've been thinking about this obsessively because I didn't know the story behind Bruce. And then when I watched the episode where Caitlyn met her mom for the first time, I was astounded. Mm-hmm. By that, at the level and how they described it is the level of deceit in terms of hiding Caitlyn to the world, she said. And I wondered and I thought, oh, this is your mom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how how much like hiding of yourself can you do with your mom? So then it, then the conspiracy theories came.
Okay. I think Caitlyn Jenner is a transgender woman. I think her struggles and her lifelong struggles around her identity, even through her marriage, and reading a bit about her background, you know, I think it would have been probably safer for her in many respects to have just remained in the kind of cis male role stardom kind of thing. And I think to finally come out in that way.
Say that again, cis.
Cisgender means it's a better word than saying transgender and normal people, like, you know. So because we'd like to know that transgender people are normal people. So cisgender means same as, which means you are born as female and you identify and live your life as female. Mm-hmm. That is cisgender.
Okay.
And so we talk about cisgender people and transgender people. I think she gave up probably quite extensive amounts of privilege as in her male life and so forth. And I think being a parent in itself could not have been easy to come out. I think there's no amount of safety that is guaranteed when you come out as transgender to anybody. There's an immense amount of risk in so many respects, losing family, losing contracts, losing so many things, you know, within your life. I think she is probably one of the luckiest transgender women in the world
ever.
You know, who can spend $150,000 on her surgery and her feminization surgery, etc. Who can have a show and then get a crash course by amazing trans feminists who are teaching her how to be a feminist live on her show.
That's a bit weird.
Which is really strange. So weird. I think her journey is interesting, etc. But I definitely think she's getting tons of backlash from the transgender community, particularly the black African-American transgender community, in relation to her political comments and, you know,
and the crazy the girls fact she hangs that around she's, with,
like, supporting Trump and Ted Cruz, and, you know, and the fact that she's a
girl
Republican,
she hangs around with.
right, exactly, and you know, the fact that she's a Republican, etc. So I think in the U.S. context, you know, there's a lot of issues around her, and she definitely does not represent the kind of issues that we as trans people face. I mean, if we look at in South Africa, you can change your gender marker. Home Affairs is pathetic around it, and they take a really long time, but you can change your gender marker. We're the only country in Africa that trans people can change their gender markers on their passports, their identity documents. We're one of the few countries, South Africa, Kenya, and possibly Zambia, is where trans people can access hormones. In those countries, it's privately. In South Africa, there's some hospitals where you can access hormones through public hospitals, like Baragwanath Hospital, etc. Now, the struggles are real here. We don't live in, you know, wherever she's staying and, you know, kind of flying little helicopters and doing those kind of things. Yeah, the struggle is real, where somebody's going to the taxi rank and will be attacked for their gender identity and their gender expression. And there's so many trans people in the region where you just can't travel because now your passport does not look like you look, and you can't open a bank account. You know, your driver's license doesn't look like you any longer, etc. And I don't know if you remember, but just about 2 years ago, a transgender woman in South Africa, Nadia Swanepoel, went on a six-day hunger strike because she had been, you know, she's a land surveyor, but since the transition, could not even find a job because Home Affairs had delayed changing her gender marker on her documents. She was then forced into sex work for a livelihood. When she had tried to travel, she had faced several deportations and imprisonment in Ireland, in Thailand, etc. So I don't think that our government really begins to understand kind of the complexities and the urgencies around changing gender markers. And just how that slow process is delaying. So many trans people could not even register for the elections. So on a very basic level, as citizens, we become non-citizens where we can't vote. We can't open bank accounts. Applying for jobs is complicated. Things like that. And so I think for us here, there's just a whole lot more that we need to change in terms of laws and policies. Schools are not equipped to understand children who transition at school. The whole complexities around all gender bathrooms. Why do we still have gender segregated bathrooms? I don't know. We all do exactly the same things in bathrooms.
Except so, we had this conversation. No one wants to share bathrooms with
hygiene,
guys.
Right?
No one wants to share bathrooms with guys. Jabu, right. This is immensely eye-opening, because as you say, the conversation is skewed on so many levels, and just having this conversation with you, I feel like we haven't even begun to scratch the surface of what is out there to be talked mm-hmm. about. And I'm deeply grateful that you took the time to come and have this conversation with me, because I really do think that only in having the conversations are we able, which is why, you know, lover or hater, Caitlin actually has broken mm-hmm. the mold right. and allowed us to talk more openly about it. And I'm very proud of you. I don't even know you and I'm proud of you. I was just like, this I don't even know you, and I'm so proud. I'm just like, Africans are amazing.
Right.
So thank you very much for coming through. I am going to put the link that says iranti.org for people to, but I'm going to please come back again and
Anytime.
Chat with us. It was awesome.
Thank you so much.
I did find, just as a goodbye, I did find a song for you by Sam Smith, but I've never heard it before. So I'm just going to play it anyway.
Fantastic.
And
thank
I hope you.
You
love it. And thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us. I'm Phumi Mashego. I've been chatting with the founder of iranti.org, Jabu Pereira, who's a transgender activist, as he likes to be called.
This is CliffCentral.com.